Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 105 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Sobalski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. If you're a regular listener, you'll already know that I love a good human story. Well, most of the people who lived before us didn't leave behind enough records to reconstruct their life stories. Some people were hugely influential within their lifetimes, allowing us to have a look into their personal struggles and triumphs and get to know them a little better. Fortunately, each time we look into these figures, we can learn something new. This week, I spoke with Helen Carr about one of the most colorful and powerful figures of the late Middle Ages, John of Gaunt. Helen is a historian who has appeared both on screen and behind the scenes for documentaries on the BBC, Discovery, CNN, and History Hit. She's also written for History Extra, History Today, and BBC History Magazine, where she's a regular features writer. Her first book is called The Red Prince, John of Gaunt, Duke of Lancaster, and it comes out this week. Here's our conversation on John of Gaunt's life, his vast influence on 14th century politics, and his enduring legacy. Well, thank you, Helen, for joining us to talk about John of Gaunt. I'm excited about this. 14th century is my favorite century, and John of Gaunt is a great topic, so I'm so happy to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, and no surprise, 14th century is my favorite too.
Yay! It's such a great century. Like, what doesn't happen in the 14th century?
Everything happens in the 14th century. It's exhausting.
And John of Gaunt was there for all of it. So let's start from the beginning and just tell people, who is John of Gaunt?
From the very beginning, John of Gaunt is the third surviving son of the warrior king, Edward III, who is famous because he initiated the start of the Hundred Years' War. And so the first part of the Hundred Years' War was really all fought under Edward III. And John of Gaunt was born pretty soon into this war. So he was born 3 years into the war in 1340 in Ghent, which is why he's called John of Gaunt, because like many of his brothers, you know, you are Edward of Woodstock or Lionel of Antwerp, and he was John of Gaunt. And he was born whilst Edward III was trying to accumulate funds to begin his war, and he borrowed a lot of money from Flanders and from the merchants in Flanders, the wealthy merchants who had capitalised on the wool trade with England. And whilst he had borrowed a lot of this money, he had to leave his wife, Philippa of Hainault, his queen consort, in Flanders, in Ghent. She was sort of acting as collateral for the loan, the enormous loan that they had given him to start the war. And John of Gaunt was essentially born in captivity in the Abbey of Saint-Bavon in Ghent.
So he's got a start that's already kind of enmeshed in all the politics at the time. Yeah, and so his childhood, we don't know all that much about his childhood, although you found a lot of records that talk about kind of the nursery and what things were like for him. But he starts to enter the world of politics and all that stuff around the age of 10. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that he had been pretty immersed in it early on because he had a very close relationship with the Black Prince. They were 10 years apart in age. And the Black Prince was trained to be, you know, a son and heir, a future king from the word go, really. And Edward III, I find it really interesting that he seemed to think that John of Gaunt, despite there being another brother between them, Lionel, he seemed to think John of Gaunt was the best person, the best companion for the Black Prince, or vice versa. And so I think as his brother was so much older than him, he learned quite quickly about the sorts of domestic and European politics that were going on at the time, because the Black Prince was so invested in that himself during John of Gaunt's childhood. But yeah, he was around 10 when he had his first taste of war.
Yes, and what was his first taste of war?
So he was taken on board the Black Prince's ship for the Battle of Winchelsea, which took place just off the coast of Winchelsea. It was so close to the coast that apparently Queen Philippa was able to stand on the clifftops and actually watch the battle take place. So this was against the Castilians, the Castilian naval fleet. And I do wonder if Edward III somewhat underestimated the abilities of the Castilians, because they had this enormous fleet. There were fewer English vessels who came to counteract them off the coast, and their ships were enormous. So the records say, some of the chronicle accounts of it, of this battle state, that the Castilian galleys were moving so fast and they were so large and strong, they could have cut through the English should they have wished to without engaging. And before the battle took place, there's another sort of chronicle account saying that they were all pretty much just getting drunk and having a laugh, waiting for the Castilians to show up. So I'm not entirely sure, you know, how we have, I mean, we think we probably have to take that with a pinch of salt. But John of Gaunt, you know, he was allowed on board the ship with his brother. It was apparently because he didn't want to leave his side, which I can believe, but also it's pretty bold of the king to let his 10-year-old son join in. And it was an incredibly bloody battle. There was a lot of hand-on-hand combat. There were stones, large stones and rocks with slingers being thrown overboard and attacking various ships. They were stealing ships, so Castilians were trying to get away with some of the English vessels, and the English were clawing them back, and some vessels were being sunk. It was all rather dramatic, and you can imagine this in the middle of the English sea as well. So you've got all the choppy waves. There's a great account of John of Gaunt's future father-in-law, which I love, of Henry, future Duke of Lancaster, who apparently swings on board the Black Prince's sinking ship, clinging onto a rope, and he swings on board going, "Darby to the rescue," which I just found hilarious. And it's like, it just feels very theatrical. And so that was his first taste of battle. The English were victorious and they did defeat the Castilians, but I can imagine that it was a pretty intense experience.
Yes, but it's got all of the pieces that you see kind of coming back up in his life later. We've got the Duke of Lancaster, who's appearing heroically, which, yeah, you know, is so chivalrous and lovely. And I hope that's true. It's probably not, but I hope that it is.
It's quite emblematic of the period, though, isn't it? This idea of chivalry and these great knightly actions. It is quite theatrical in that it's a performance. It's a demonstration of said chivalry. And it's always to rescue or to put oneself in danger for the benefit of others.
Yeah, and that's something that seems to come up in John of Gaunt's life quite a lot. So he fully enters the Hundred Years' War. He fights alongside his brother. What are some of the things that happened to him in the course of his military history? Because he's had some exciting adventures.
Yeah. So John of Gaunt is lesser remembered for his military action. It's largely his brother, the Black Prince. And I think one of the most surprising things for me when, you know, I first started researching the Hundred Years' War, and I think would be surprising to some of the readers of the book, is there weren't actually that many battles that took place in the Hundred Years' War. So we think of all the famous battles, Poitiers, Crecy, but that's like two major battles on French soil that take place in the course of all of this fighting. Like, a lot of the action, or lack of action, I should really say, was the English campaigning in France, trying to get the French to come out from behind their chateaus and fight. And the French tended to employ scorched earth tactics, which was they would just strip the land of all supplies in the hope that it would beat the English back and they would be forced to retreat. And largely this kind of worked, because every time the French came out and engaged with the English, they lost. So they found a way of just avoiding combat. So this was a certain trope that just continued throughout the Hundred Years' War, depending on what French king was on the throne at the time. And John of Gaunt's first experience of military life was on these campaigns and was just the sort of traipsing through France, conducting small raids. He might have been embroiled in a couple of minor skirmishes here and there, but it was largely raiding towns, destroying the land. And he never reached the French in the same pitched battle scenario as you got at Crecy when the Black Prince won his spurs, or even as his brother did at Poitiers. So he never really had that experience. But what he did learn is, I think, a lot more about the politics of the war. And that definitely comes out later on in his life. He was a fantastic diplomat and politician. He wasn't the most effective military leader, though it's possible he could have been quite unlucky. And it could have been that the King of England, Edward III, and the Black Prince were just lucky and fortunate that the French decided that in these two particular scenarios, they would come out and meet and engage in pitched battle. So I think it's unfair to sort of paint John of Gaunt as an ineffective military leader, as he has been painted in the past. His first major victory, though, and his one experience, his formative experience of pitch battle, was an important one. It was a big battle. And this was the Battle of Nahara, which happened in 1367. And this largely gets forgotten about in the scope of the battles of the Hundred Years' War, because, you know, you've got Agincourt, Crecy, Poitiers. Nobody really remembers Nahara because it wasn't really directly between England and France. They were the kind of supporting allies of the battle rather than the, you know, the two opposing major forces. So this emerged, and this was really important in John of Gaunt's life. It kind of paved the way for everything that went forward. So this came out of a fraternal feud in Spain. So in this period, Spain was split into various kingdoms. So you had the Kingdom of Aragon, Castile and León in the middle, which is the really big bit. And then you had Navarre at the top, and then you had Portugal, but then you also had the Alhambra, and you had where all the Granada, where it was largely Moorish territory. So there was this feud in Castile and León between two brothers. There was a King Pedro, who is nicknamed for posterity Pedro the Cruel, and we'll go into that later because I think he probably was pretty cruel. And then he had his stepbrother, Enrique Trastamara. And Enrique basically sought alliance with the French, and Pedro sought alliance with the English. And he was these two feuding brothers who were fighting for the throne of Castile. So this was a time of a truce or relative peace. There wasn't a huge amount of, you know, there was no active war going on between England and France at this point. But this sort of sparked it again because they kind of came and inadvertently fought each other in Spain through these two warring brothers. This all came to a head at the Battle of Nahara, where John of Gaunt led the vanguard. So the vanguard is the first line of the army. It's the centre and the first line of the charge. And there are some great accounts of this battle that took place. So Chandos Herald, who's one of the great military accounts of the Hundred Years' War, who wrote The Life of the Black Prince. He talks about John of Gaunt fighting boldly. And again, you know, like any chronicle source, you have to take it with a pinch of salt, but it does add colour to the history. And we know that they were successful in this battle. They won and they beat back not only Enrique Trastamara and the Spanish force, but they also beat back the commander Bertrand de Guesclin. And if you know anything about the Hundred Years' War and military history in France, you'll know that Bertrand de Guesclin, the Constable of France, was a revered, iconic warrior in France. So much so, when he died, he was posthumously cut up and his parts of his body were boiled and sent to various churches in France because he was so important. And he often defeated the English or managed to sort of outfox them. So they managed to beat Bertrand de Guesclin and even take him prisoner in this battle. And then after the battle, which was really important as well, because John of Gaunt was fighting alongside his brother, the Black Prince. They were literally brothers in arms. And so that was a really special experience to be fighting alongside the man who had, in effect, raised him in many ways. And after the battle, I said I'd say why Pedro was cruel. He apparently requested to pay the prisoners weight in gold so he could butcher them. And, you know, we were talking about chivalry earlier. This isn't very chivalrous.
No.
Prisoners in the 14th century were treated well. You know, the idea of taking a prisoner was that this was how you made money on war, because you'd always try and aim for the high-born men. So you could then take them as prisoner, treat them really well, and their families would pay an enormous ransom. And, you know, some people really enjoyed being prisoners. You had King John of France, who had a great time being a prisoner in England when the Black Prince captured him at Poitiers. I mean, he didn't want to go back and rule in France. He was like, why would I want to go back? I'm sat here in the Savoy Palace drinking wine from Gascony and I don't have to do anything. So some prisoners had a wonderful time and they, you know, they stayed often in England and vice versa. So for the Pedro the Cruel to then ask to pay for these prisoners just to butcher them was a pretty hideous and heinous crime in itself. And of course, the Black Prince and John of Gaunt were pretty shocked and said no. That was his kind of leading moment in the Hundred Years' War. After this point, the Black Prince got very sick. And that's when English politics started to burden John of Gaunt. He had to take over the Black Prince's position for a year in Aquitaine, and he was appointed as Lieutenant of Aquitaine to try and repair the mess that arose out of the Black Prince's campaign into Castile, which never was repaid by Pedro. And so John of Gaunt was given a very difficult task around this time in Aquitaine, which was largely political. And then he returned to England, and he was pretty bogged down in domestic politics thereafter.
Yes. Well, I love how the Black Prince, he's sick. He can't take over Aquitaine much as he would like to, I'm sure. And so they ask for John of Gaunt to do this, and he says, okay, but only for a year, because I really don't want to do this.
Yeah.
I think that really speaks to his power, the power he's always had within the family and within the political climate, that he can say, I'm only doing it for a year, and then he leaves. But as you say, he's a great diplomat. I didn't realize before reading this book how much influence he had in the politics with Scotland, especially, which is really fraught in the 14th century. So yeah, real diplomat.
Yeah, he was. He was a very successful diplomat, and he was well liked. And I think that this comes out at the end of the book as well, which I'm sure we'll talk about, because when his son, Henry Bolingbroke, is exiled, he advises him to go to the Valois princes, because he says, you know, he's popular there. John of Gaunt is well liked and respected by them. And he knows that they will ensure his son's safety and the potential release of his banishment as well. So I think that he is popular as a diplomat. He's a very successful diplomat. He spends so much time repairing situations, like when the bishop, Henry de Spencer, goes off to Flanders to enact his crusade. He makes a complete pig's ear out of it, and John of Gaunt has to go and patch it up. And so, yeah, he is an effective diplomat. He does a very good job. And you mentioned the Scots. He's popular in Scotland. Before his interest in Castile and Spain, there was an idea floated that he would succeed David II as the heir to the throne in Scotland. And this was from a very young age. You know, he was late teens when this was suggested. And I think that Edward III saw something in him as a very young man, that he was capable and he was fair and he was a good leader. Whether he was a good leader on the battlefield is a different question, but I think that he wasn't really given as much opportunity. And I think, you know, now we popularize leadership in battle, if you're thinking about the medieval period, because it's exciting and interesting. And actually, I don't think we should give it that much space. I think actually leadership is better demonstrated when you look at the way people, magnates, manage their land and their people. And John of Gaunt did all of that very effectively. And he was well liked in countries that were contentious with the Crown of England.
Yeah. And I think that's important to remember in the fact that he's a complex figure, because he's not always remembered well. And in part, that's because he was not a friend of the commons, at least in London. He seems to have been a friend of the commons, at least the people that he was overseeing on his lands. But the Londoners were not his biggest fans. So can you get into that a little bit? Why did London hate him so much?
Yeah, so this happened. He made enemies in London. It was partly because I think that they were suspicious of his interest in Castile. So after he comes back from Aquitaine, he was widowed in 1368 from his first wife, Blanche, which is where he inherited the dukedom of Lancaster through her and her father, Henry. He was widowed. Blanche died in 1368. He then went off to help his brother in Aquitaine. He then became lieutenant of Aquitaine. Whilst he was there, this is following the Battle of Nahara, and during this time, King Pedro the Cruel was killed. He was murdered by his brother. All of that support and that battle kind of was there for nothing. He's ended up being murdered by him in a man of man combat with them rolling around in the dust. So why you didn't just cut to the chase immediately, who knows? So Pedro left two daughters. He had two heirs. There was Constance and her younger sister, Isabella. And they fled to Bordeaux, to the court of the Black Prince, for protection. And whilst John of Gaunt was there, it is thought that the idea was floated to him that he marry the eldest daughter, because then his heirs, and I think this is really important, that the actual source says his heirs will then have a chance effectively of ruling Castile and perhaps himself. But John of Gaunt takes this as, I could have a chance of ruling Castile. So he doesn't really think so much about the heirs. I think he does later on, but his initial thought is, I could have a chance of ruling Castile. I could have a chance of kingship. And so he very quickly is pretty excited to go and marry Constance. She's only 17, but he doesn't even wait for her to get to the court at Bordeaux. He actually leaves Bordeaux, meets her on the road, and is like, right, well, let's get on with it. Let's get married. And they get married in a very unceremonious wedding. And so he brings Constance back to England when he returns from Aquitaine. And she's placed at Hertford Castle, but with her comes this new title. So he calls himself King of Castile and Leon, and he changes his coat of arms, his seal, which is really beautifully and immaculately represented. It's at the National Archives, and you can see it. And it goes from his Duchy of Lancaster seal to his Castile and Leon seal alongside the leopards of England as well and the fleur-de-lis of France. So he's really creating a statement saying, I am king of this land. But what's awkward for people in London in particular is that they've got two kings, which is a very strange dynamic. So John of Gaunt is calling himself king. In the sources, he's called King of Spain in everything that he signs and referred to. And I think this causes tension. People don't really know why this is happening. They don't trust his European ambitions. They don't trust the idea that a English prince wants to become king of a different country altogether. You know, it's very different from the King of England saying, I'm King of England and France, to John of Gaunt, who's a magnate, saying, I'm actually now King of Spain. It's an uncomfortable dynamic. And there's also an element of anti-European culture going on here, because they don't like the Spaniards coming into London. They're not very popular. There was a lot of cultural discord in this period between people of various backgrounds. So people didn't like that. They were suspicious of these foreign Spanish courtiers that John of Gaunt was packing the Savoy with. So that was quite early on in the 1370s. And then I think that he became particularly unpopular in the Good Parliament in 1376. So this was when Edward III was aging and he had begun to lose control of domestic politics. There's a lot of corrupt action going on in his immediate coterie of advisors. So people were siphoning money off from the wool exports. There were licenses being sold, which meant that certain merchants could avoid the tax. There was all sorts of shifty things going on, and Edward III had sort of lost control of it. He was just having it away with Alice Perez and having a wonderful time in the last few years of his life. And so he didn't really want to get involved in this parliament, which he knew was going to be contentious. Of course, the Black Prince was incredibly sick. And John of Gaunt was then left as the representative of the king. So he was left to hear the grievances of the commons. And boy, did they have some grievances. And so John of Gaunt tried to adhere to the commons' requests. He had Alice Perez removed from his father's bedside. He had her investigated. And she was accused at one point of infecting the king's mind with the help of a necromancer. Of course, you know, the classic, you must be a witch. And so he was in a really, really tricky position, because he had his incredibly sick brother and a father who just wasn't able to apply himself to this difficult position. But then he was also trying to protect them, protect the name of the royal family, protect the honour of the king. He couldn't bear that the king's dirty laundry was being aired in front of the commons. John of Gaunt was a royalist. He was very like, you know, these commons, you know. He looked after his people, but he definitely saw himself as above the people. And he started to make enemies out of this, especially after the Good Parliament, when the commons had got everything they requested and they were celebrating. A few months later, John of Gaunt began to unpick everything. And he started to put everything back as it was before. And he threw the Speaker of the House of Commons, Peter de la Mare, in prison in Nottingham Castle, which was just not a great move. And he also fell out with the Bishop of London. And he was also around this time starting to support the views of John Wycliffe, who was the famous Lollard preacher at the time and who has been subsequently nicknamed as the flower of the Reformation. So he was supporting some of these very anti-Catholic viewpoints. He fell out with the Bishop of London, who was revered in London by the people. He was starting to unpick the work of the commons. He was falling out with the merchant oligarchs in London. He had major enemies in that faction because around this time, the crown was starting to rely on wealthy merchant funds. But with that, the wealthy merchant classes were starting to sort of eke up the echelons of the nobility, which John of Gaunt had a major issue with. So that's effectively why he became unpopular in London. And his palace, the Savoy, the first time it was attacked was actually in 1377, and his arms were reversed, which is the sign of your arms are reversed as the sign of a traitor.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, his palace gets completely destroyed in the Peasants' Revolt. That is, he's a major target of the Peasants' Revolt. Mm-hmm. So at this time, the peasants are seeing him as an actual enemy of the people. So what happens during the Peasants' Revolt in terms of what's happening to John of Gaunt?
Yeah, he's totally vindicated in the Peasants' Revolt. I mean, one of their chants kind of coming into London to speak with the king is, "We will have no king named John," which harks back to this idea of the Castilian king. And I think it's one of those things that in London, he was particularly unpopular. I don't believe that he was particularly unpopular outside of London. He was certainly popular in certain areas of the country, in places like Leicester. He was really popular. They defended him during the Peasants' Revolt. So the Londoners had real issues with John of Gaunt. I think that those outside of London from Essex and Kent, they were suspicious of him. They were suspicious again of this idea of him being a king. They didn't like that. It was uncomfortable. I don't think it went too much further than that. And that's why they said, you know, we will have no king named John. I think there was fear that he was out to usurp the crown of the young prince, now King Richard II, who was only 14. There's this kind of perpetuating idea, which you get throughout history, of the evil uncle. And I think that John of Gaunt has sort of been cast as this Richard III type figure for much of history. And actually, he really wasn't. He wasn't interested in Richard's crown. But the people believe that he was. And it was one of those rumours that spread quite commonly that he wanted to take the throne for himself. And if you think back to medieval thought process, this is saying you are effectively removing a spokesperson or a representative of God. And so people were suspicious of him. So I think that's where that came from. But he was particularly unpopular in London, and his palace, the Savoy Palace, was attacked largely by London rebels. So once the Kent and Essex rebels, led by Wat Tyler, John Ball, once they came into the city, you also had the party of rebels in the city who got involved, and that was their opportunity to strike at John of Gaunt. So you had the king, the Archbishop of Canterbury, the treasurer, etc., in the Tower of London. John of Gaunt's palace, the Savoy, was quite close to Westminster. So where the Savoy Hotel is now, for anybody who's familiar with London and its layout, it was literally right there. And that's why I love that whole area, because it has really been, the palace has been immortalized with the sort of same level of luxury as the hotel. and so his nephew, Sir Richard, they were all safe in the tower. Well, you'd think they might be safe. They weren't in the end, but they were safe in the tower. And John of Gaunt was, fortunately for him, not in London. He had gone up to Scotland. He was on a mission in Scotland. So he had been sent up to arrange a series of march days, which are like peace talks with the Scots. So fortunately for him, he was on Berwick-on-Tweed when his palace was attacked. And they managed to get in with relative ease, despite, you know, the fact it was very pretty and crenellated. They got in with no real issue. And they were just having a great time sacking his palace. They just destroyed all of his belongings, all of his goods. They created a huge pyre in the Great Hall. And every medieval magnate in a fine house would have the Great Hall. It was the central feature of your property. They were picking out headboards encrusted with jewels, tapestries, barrels filled with plate, so expensive plate, gold. They were rolling it all onto this pyre. And whilst they were doing that, a bunch of rebels, about 30, apparently found their way into the cellars where John of Gaunt kept all of his delicious wine from Gascony. And they got really drunk. So they had a party down in the cellars, and it was literally described as they're having a revel. What they didn't realise was that this fire was being lit above them. And some of the items that were put on the fire were actually barrels of gunpowder, little did the rebels know. Because John of Gaunt was preparing for a campaign into Castile at the time, storing gunpowder at the Savoy. So the walls of the Savoy come crashing down, and these poor rebels get trapped inside the cellars. The rest of the faction go on, and they continue to march through London. And then obviously, famously, the Archbishop of Canterbury is found in the Tower of London, and dragged outside and executed along with the treasurer. And Richard II finally meets the rebels, and they are disbanded. So John of Gaunt was very fortunate that he wasn't there, but actually his son, Henry Bolingbroke, even more miraculously survives by apparently hiding inside a cupboard whilst the treasurer and the Archbishop of Canterbury are dragged outside to meet their bitter fate. And then Richard II famously manages to disband these armed rebels. And I think that this is, even though John of Gaunt wasn't present in this moment, I think this is really important for his life going forward, because I think this is the moment Richard feels he gains some sense of autonomy in his kingship, but also this kind of very preposterous sense of God-given power that seems to be something that continues into the rest of his reign. And his relationship with John of Gaunt is very different from this point. And indeed, John of Gaunt's sense of identity is very different from this point. It's really important to understand that before the Peasants' Revolt, John of Gaunt was this powerful magnate. He was effectively a regent with Richard II. He was guiding his nephew. He was revered. He was incredibly powerful. What John of Gaunt said went. And he was also conducting a love affair with Catherine Swynford, who is his famous mistress, and he was treating her as a wife. So he had poor Constance in Hertford or Tutbury Castle with her ladies, but then he was doing everything with Catherine. And, you know, this made him really unpopular. It made him really unpopular with the church, for sure. Thomas Walsingham, who is monk of St. Albans, described him as a fornicator and adulterer, which is a pretty harsh thing to say to somebody in the 14th century.
Yeah, so, not wrong though, not wrong.
He was an adulterer, he certainly was. So he was, you know, he was having this love affair with Catherine, and when the news reached him of what happened during the Peasants' Revolt and what was happening in London and what happened to the Savoy Palace, he sort of took this turn of massive repentance. And you see it in the chronicle accounts, but if you also read it alongside his register, which is a great source for seeing his immediate actions following the revolt, you see so much of this kind of vulnerability and not knowing where he stands, where's he going, what's he going to do, where does he arm, where does he send the wood to support his household to keep them warm, where does he send food, and actually he is then forced to actually stay in Scotland and be cared for and looked after and protected by the Scots, which is a massive position, considering the Scots could as well as kill him help him, because the peace between them is so new. It was an opportunity for the Scots in a way to begin a war on the back of the Peasants' Revolt, whilst England was in so much turmoil under a young king. They had their key figure there. They could do anything they wanted, but they protected him. And they were good to him, and he gifted them well, generously, because of this. And following the Peasants' Revolt, he finished his relationship with Catherine, which had been going on for a considerable amount of time. They had four children together, Their relationship is quite famous. And I think that this did have an emotional significance for him, because about a month after the revolt, in July, I think it was, he erected a shrine to St. Catherine at Knaresborough. And I think that that is representative of respect and affection that he had for her.
Yeah. Well, they have been together for something like 10 years, 9 years or something like that at the time.
Yeah.
And that kind of brings us full circle, because we do need to get to the end of John of Gaunt's life. And at the end of his life, he is back with Catherine again after 15 years. They get back together, which is a great story. This is all a great story. And that actually shapes English history from there, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So at the end of his life, he goes to Castile, tries to get the throne, it doesn't work out. Poor John of Gaunt ends up having a terrible time, loses like half his army to plague. And then he comes back to England a very different man. He comes back just wanting to consolidate himself and his loyalties and his life. And he's a peacemaker. He just wants peace. He tries to broker a continuous, lasting peace with France. He's incredibly focused on that in the last few years of his life. And Constance dies. 2 years later, he marries Catherine, and they have a very small ceremony. I think this is largely to do with the conflict that he is having about his personal piety and the ways in his life that he might have offended God. And I think that he blames a lot on his infidelity and his very blatant relationship with Catherine. You see this in the rumours that circulated around his death, and you also see this in his actions, his weird actions on his death, which I'll go into. But I think that he does this to care for her, to protect her, and also to protect his Beaufort children. So he marries Catherine to legitimise his children. Richard at this point has become an incredibly volatile and unpredictable king. His key focus in the last few years of his life is wholly in protecting his family and his dynasty. This is all around the time in the wake of the Lords Appellant, of which his son Henry Bolingbroke was one of them. And I think if John of Gaunt had been in England, he would have certainly advised that Henry avoid becoming a Lord Appellant. I don't think that he would have been supportive of Henry's actions with that. I think he would have seen the danger that put Henry in. And indeed, the Lords Appellant were all punished. One of them, the Earl of Arundel, was even executed. And of course, famously, the Duke of Gloucester, Richard's uncle, was murdered in Calais. He was smothered by a feather mattress under the orders of the king. So, you know, John of Gaunt's only son and heir is actually in a really precarious position at the end of John of Gaunt's life. This is the son that's going to inherit the Duchy of Lancaster, a duchy that John of Gaunt has so much respect for and has worked very hard to maintain throughout his life. It's the dynasty of his father-in-law, Henry, Duke of Lancaster, and, you know, one of the last great knights. He's terrified that Richard is going to get his hands on this land and strip Henry of his title. And indeed, he does try and do that. After John of Gaunt's death, he does try and steal the Duchy of Lancaster. And we all know that Henry of Bolingbroke comes back and lands at Ravenspur and ousts Richard, throws him into Pontefract Castle, where he starves to death. But John of Gaunt, up until this point, you know, following his death, everything comes crashing down, because that is when Henry does act, comes back to England, he claims back his birthright. But before he died, John of Gaunt, yes, is incredibly invested in protecting his family. So he's legitimised the Beauforts, he's married Catherine, he's trying to create peace and unity between England and France. Richard marries the young Princess Isabella, who at the time is only something like 7 years old. She is put in Catherine Swinford's care at this point. So John of Gaunt is doing all he can to create a safe space, a safe England on his death. And it's very tragic, because the famous duel that you get in Shakespeare in Richard II between Thomas Mowbray and Henry Bolingbroke does indeed happen shortly before Gaunt's death, except Richard does actually, as it is in the play, he stops the duel before it can take place. It's this really tense and almost palpable sense of control and dictatorship. It's so weird. It's almost like he has power tingling from his fingertips, and he just wants to play with it. And he wants to play with these puppet people. And it's a very awkward dynamic to write. And so he's got these last two Lords Appellant that he's managed to make play the most incredible political game, in that they end up fighting each other, and he banishes both of them. So John of Gaunt never gets to say a proper, on his deathbed, goodbye to his son. So he dies finally in Leicester Castle in February 1399, and Henry is told much later, Richard doesn't even tell Henry, and he's devastated, and he has a service, a sort of a memorial service for Gaunt, a requiem for Gaunt in France, which the French nobility all come to. It shows again, you know, he is deeply respected as a figure. And that's before he makes his journey back to England and he decides that he has a choice. He can either accept Richard stripping him entirely of his lands and refusing that he's ever allowed to come back into the country. His banishment from 6 years to a lifetime after John of Gaunt's death. And he protects the English crown and the rightful successor being Richard. Or he comes back and he fights back for his land and he overthrows him and he takes the crown for himself. So he's thrust into this position of what do I do? And John of Gaunt, for his whole life, he swore to his brother, the Black Prince, that he would oversee Richard's succession. And this feud that you can't win, you know, I don't think John of Gaunt would have been happy with the way that the crown was taken from Richard and the way that his son became king. I think that he was too honourable and loyal for that to his father and to his brother. However, it did shape his dynasty going forward. And I think the dynasty he wanted to create while he was alive actually happened shortly after his death. So you have Henry IV becoming the first Lancastrian king of England, and then you get Henry V, his son, and thereafter Henry VI. But then you also get the Beauforts. So much further down the family tree, let's go into the sort of Tudor world, you've got Margaret Beaufort, who is John of Gaunt's granddaughter, great-granddaughter or granddaughter, one of them. And she is the only way that her son, Henry Tudor, has a right to the throne of England, which all plays out at the Battle of Bosworth, so a century later. The English throne thereafter, following Gaunt's death, everything can be traced back to him, even through the Wars of the Roses. And not only this, his daughter, Catherine, that he has with Constance of Castile, Catherine is married to the Prince of Asturias in Spain, and through her comes Catherine of Aragon. So you then get the Spanish royal line as well coming through John of Gaunt. So, you know, when people ask me what is his legacy, and I say, well, he is in a way, you know, he's a very European prince, but he's also the father of monarchy as we know it.
Absolutely. That's a great soundbite. That's great. I think that one of the things you say at the beginning of the book is that he's kind of fallen out of fashion. He used to be really fashionable for people to think about and write about, and he's not so much anymore. So I think that maybe has to do with nostalgia or something like that. But I'm really glad that you've brought John of Gaunt back around so that people can learn more about him, because he's a very interesting figure in his own right.
Yeah, he is. And, you know, he was, I think that I've told John of Gaunt's story in a very different way. I've never read anything that has highlighted where he fits within the grander story of the 14th century. And for me, writing this book, you know, there have been deep archival dives into the Lancastrian administration, and I think those have been done immaculately. And I haven't sought to repeat that. But what I wanted to do was tell John of Gaunt's story through the context of what was happening at the time. You know, it's not just about the man himself. I believe it's very much the world around him that shaped him. So I think that this book is not only a deep dive into John of Gaunt's life, but it's a deep dive into the second half of the 14th century.
I think that comes off. So congratulations on the book. Is it out now? I think it's out, just coming out now, isn't it?
So it's out on Thursday. So recording this on Tuesday, so it's out on the 15th of April. So by the time this is released, it should be out. And I finished recording the audiobook. So if people like audio content, then you can get it on audiobook as well and on Kindle.
That's awesome. Well, congratulations on the book. And thank you for bringing John of Gaunt to the Medieval Podcast.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
For having me.
To find out more about Helen's work, you can find her on Twitter at Helen H. Carr or Instagram at Helen M. H. Carr. Her book, The Red Prince, John of Gaunt, Duke of Lancaster, is available this week in the United Kingdom and later this spring elsewhere. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's going on this week, Peter?
Hey, well, it's spring is in the air. So we've got Lucie Lemonnier writing about spring in the Middle Ages, the time of agriculture and love. So we got that. Stephen Mulberger has written a piece on St. George and his banner. We also have Anna Kamena and the First Crusade, and a story about a 16th century Korean icon, Hwang Jin-yi. So that was, I thought, was a pretty cool story of a poetess at the end of the Korean Middle Ages.
Nice. That is a strong week. Strong content, strong writers. I love it.
A lot of fun stuff this week.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks.
Thank you, as always, to our patrons on patreon.com for your help keeping the Medieval Podcast going. I've noticed that we've added a few more patrons since last week's episode, so thank you so much for joining, and welcome. Patrons can choose from all sorts of great stuff, like subscriptions to Medieval Warfare Magazine and the Medieval Magazine, membership in our book club, and our awesome maps by Tina Ross. To become a patron of the Medieval Podcast, please visit patreon.com/medievalists. For everything from royals to rebels, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can find me, Danielle Sabalski, on social media at 5minmedievalist or 5minutemedievalist. You can check out my masterclass at medievalmasterclass.com. You can find my books, including How to Live Like a Monk, Medieval Wisdom for Modern Life, on amazon.com. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Geefrog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself an amazing day.